think it's the money, don't you? The money in the fund. I won't know what to think until you get me that DNA sample. I hang up without saying goodbye and open the browser on my desktop. The Gates website features an elaborate series of flash animations which I click through impatiently until I find the Circle of Healing. When I click on the link, an animated drop of water falls into the middle of the words, pushing them out into concentric circles that ripple over the whole screen. When the screen goes smooth again, this description appears. We invite to the Circle of Healing all who feel broken. When we ask forgiveness in the Circle of Healing, God will show us that we have already been healed. At the bottom of the screen, a series of faces fade in and out, each with a testimonial. An elderly woman blinded by cataracts until the Circle of Healing taught her she could already see. An African-American teenager saved from dropping out of school by the Circle of Healing. A man, once homeless, discovered the path to financial security through the Circle of Healing. God's plan is for abundance, the quote says. The Lord makes his kingdom great. I scribble the meeting times on a post-it note and go back to the search screen where another listing is a link to a recent magazine profile of Reverend Chuck Maxwell, the man whose face looms over our local urban landscape on billboards at every bottleneck. The article is called, It Ain't Luck, Chuck, How Reverend Chuck Maxwell Landed the Biggest Pulpit in Texas. Chuck Maxwell is handsomer in person than on the billboards for his Houston megachurch, The Gate. The 42-year-old pastor with a grizzled beard and piercing stare is 6'2" and unexpectedly graceful. It's easy to see how this man has built a spiritual and financial empire. Oh, it's going to be one of those profiles. Maxwell has never been ordained in any denomination, nor does he hold degrees in religion or philosophy. Indeed, he never finished college. Yet every week he stands in what was once the Houston Astrodome and delivers a sermon to 30,000 parishioners and up to 10 million remote viewers via his television and internet ministries. I skip down a few paragraphs. After dropping out of Texas Christian University, he snagged a production job for Houston's fire and brimstone televangelist Jim Wilton. It was there that Maxwell says he began to have strong ideas for a Christian message he felt uniquely suited to deliver. I wouldn't say I had a falling out with a Baptist church, he says, but the message was so negative. You're messing up. Get right with God. He laughs. But God doesn't want you to focus on your sins of the past. God says, make it new. My English professor I snags on make it new, Ezra Pound's modernist slogan, and I enjoy a brief moment of imagining the elitist, anti-Semitic old creep rolling in his grave. I keep skimming. And Maxwell keeps preaching endless reinvention, spreading the word that nothing matters but the present moment. Could that be what Julie's after? The profile goes on for 3 more pages, covering Maxwell's massive donations to a nonprofit for missing children. That, of course, catches my eye. But I can't stomach reading to the end. The thought of Julie needing Maxwell's message, erase the past, live in the now, is too repellent to dwell on. Jane and Tom and I are, after all, Julie's past. Or we're supposed to be. Which brings me to my final call. I get out the piece of paper Jane gave me, still wadded up in my pocket, and stare at it. The area code looks familiar, but I can't quite place it until I look it up. Seattle. Jane must be playing some kind of trick on me. This is the phone number of a friend of hers, her roommate, somebody she's put up to this. I feel a hot rush of anger followed by a guilty twinge. I've neglected Jane, willfully ignored her at times, over the past 8 years. Every time I looked at her, all I could see was her failure to scream in the closet that night. The 3 hours she spent huddled among her shoes with tears and snot streaming down her face while Julie... I know it wasn't Jane's fault, but I couldn't help it. Casting doubts on Julie's identity would be a particularly cruel way to get back at me, but effective. My hand is shaking. I dial the number and wait. It rings 6 times, as if someone on the other end is staring at the caller ID, deciding whether to pick up. Then someone does. Stop this, Julie says. I'm shocked into silence. Well... Say something, Cal, she says, her voice weary. I finally picked up one of your mystery numbers, so say something. I know it's you. Calling from every stop on your grand tour of my life, aren't you? She pauses. Well, you found me. You're here, so what is it you want to say? I hold my breath. What dirty little secret have you found out about me now? I guarantee, no matter what it is, there's something worse about me you still don't know. I know nothing. Absolutely nothing. On the other end of the connection, Julie says, Fuck you, Cal. I left. It's over. Go home. The call ends. Charlotte sat in a dingy room with a social worker and a bearded man who kept trying to get her to tell him the name of her pimp. Officer Pete used that word, too, but she didn't know what it meant, just that there was a thrill of secrets around it, like a curse word. It made her think of pimples, but she wasn't telling the bearded man that. I don't have one of those, she said, unable to make herself repeat the word.
Come on. What did he tell you?
Said the bearded man.
He told you were special. He'd treat you right.
The only person she could think of who fit that description was John David. Was he a pimp? Her pimp? She wasn't sure. There was no way this bearded man could know about John David, was there? But a deep black well hovered just under that thought, waiting for her to slip and fall in. She shook her head.
He convinced you to start trading it for money, right? Only he gets all the money.
Now she understood, and a wave of heat exploded just under her jaw.
I've only done that a couple times, she mumbled.
Okay, just once or twice, he said in a too-nice voice, just to help him out. So you want to protect him because he protects you, right? You think he's your friend, maybe your boyfriend.
I don't have a boyfriend, she said,
the heat spreading up from her jawline until even her eyeballs felt hot. She pushed all her hate out through her eyes and straight into his bushy brown beard. At least Officer Pete believed her. She drew a breath to say so, but realized she didn't know Officer Pete's real name.
He bought you things at first, the beard continued to prompt her. Maybe he got your nails done.
She pulled her hands off the table self-consciously. There were lines of black beneath the ragged nails, and one had a red puffy bump of skin around the corner where it was torn. She noticed the social worker, a brown-skinned woman with a pair of glasses on a chain around her neck, shake her head and roll her eyes quickly, then look away. But the bearded guy went on for another 5 or 10 minutes before finally standing up. He flipped a card onto the table in front of her, pressing one finger down on its corner as he said,
If you remember anything, call me at this number. Just remember, he's a predator. You're the victim here.
As he lifted his hand away, his sweaty finger tugged the corner of the card just enough to knock it out of its perfect alignment with the fake wood grain on the table. She watched the card settle into its skewed position in front of her, memorizing the angle to keep from reading the name. When she looked up, the man was gone, and the social worker had taken his seat across the table from her with an expression of clear relief.
I'm Wanda, Charlotte.
She almost jumped. Although it was the name she'd put on the paperwork, the first one that popped into her head, nobody had called her that yet. The cops who'd shuffled her from room to room had said, you, or young lady, or, when they were talking about her like she wasn't there, the juvenile. Hearing the name said out loud for the first time, she realized how weak and stupid she had been to use it, just because it made her feel brave to claim it as her own. Now it sounded like an accusation.
Charlotte, Wanda went on, as if determined to damn her as often as possible. I was told you'd like to be in foster care. We call it out-of-home care these days. Do you have a safe home?
She tried to think of home, but instead she saw a pair of blank, staring, upside-down eyes. Their unwet opacity.
No.
You don't have a home? Wanda prodded. Or you feel it's not safe for you there?
It sounded like a trick question. This Wanda wasn't like Officer Pete, mouthing off after a long day, or the asshole with a beard, drilling down in hopes of finding something in her he could use. No home or not safe.
She stared at the corners of Wanda's mouth, watching for a flicker to tell her which one the social worker wanted to hear. But Wanda only waited, her face relaxed and expressionless.
Where to begin?
Not safe.
It wasn't exactly a lie.
Wanda just nodded, an expression not so much of approval but of completion, a box ticked off.
And, Charlotte, are you hoping to be in out-of-home care for just a short time or for a longer while?
Multiple choice again. She'd been good at tests once.
I want an emergency placement, she said, remembering what Officer Pete told her to say.
I'd like that for you too, Charlotte, the social worker said. Unfortunately, we have a shortage of options just at the moment. Child Protective Services will handle all that. I'm just making the referral. But I have to tell you something. If you're entering out-of-home care right now, you're very likely going to have to stay in a group home for a time while they look for a placement for you.
She nodded. Group.
It'll only be temporary, but I just want to prepare you for that. Are you sure there's not a friend or family member you could stay with? Somewhere you'll be safe? Think.
She thought, hard this time. All the places she could go, she'd need to be a kid. And she wasn't a kid anymore. Kids didn't go to dirty apartments and have babies scraped out of them. Kids didn't do with Pete's what she'd done with Pete's. Kids didn't do to other kids what she'd done to the girl in the basement. She didn't know what she was.
I'll go to group, she said.
As the two of them left the police station, she said,
What about my things?
But even before Wanda opened her mouth to say the words, Charlotte knew the stolen knife was gone forever. It didn't matter, because in group, only the biggest kids got to have knives. They hid them in their mattresses or taped them to the bottoms of drawers. Nobody stole them, and nobody told on the kids. One of the scrawny little boys tried making his own out of a plastic butter knife that he snapped in half. He showed it around, bragging, until one of the big kids took it away in the night and did something to him that didn't show. Because of obvious rules like that, group was easier than she'd thought it would be. In her mind, she called the biggest kids enforcers. She herself tried to be an invisible, obviously the safest course of action. Her roommate Beth was an eager. Eagers played along with whatever the counselors asked, volunteering in group sessions and earning gold stars and sparkly toothbrushes and puffy stickers for good behavior. The stars and puffy stickers were worse than pointless, too permanent. They left a hard, sticky gum behind that ruined clothes and had to be scrubbed off skin with a scouring pad. The undersides of the chairs and the walls behind the beds were lousy with them. Toothbrushes were different. She'd lived without one before, and the flimsy plastic stick they handed her when she first arrived was better than nothing, but its thin row of stiff, hard bristles hurt her gums. One day she picked up Beth's toothbrush and flipped it over, looking into the pink, translucent depths of the sparkly plastic, letting her eyes slide along the buried bubbles and shimmering threads that caught the light as she turned it from side to side.
Hey! Put that down, that's mine, said Beth from the doorway.
It's nice, said Charlotte, but she didn't put the toothbrush down. She waited to see what Beth would do. Beth, who was only 11, wriggled uncomfortably.
It's pretty, Charlotte added encouragingly. Thanks, said Beth.
After a brief interior struggle, her wide eyes almost filling with tears, she said,
You can have it.
Her teeth dragging on every syllable. Charlotte put it down with a thwack.
That's gross. I don't want your used toothbrush.
But later on, she took it anyway. 11. Monday afternoon, I get in the car and head to the gate. Ironic, isn't it? I've been telling Tom for 2 weeks I'm going to work. And Julie's been telling us she's going to therapy, and now we're both lying to go to the same place. I turn into the parking lot where new construction shields the former Astrodome from the neighboring NRG Stadium and take note of the aerial walkway between the two buildings. The gate must get a healthy amount of foot traffic during playoff season. As if on cue, the digital marquee flashes, "With God, all things are possible," and I give an anxious snort of laughter. There are 100 or so vehicles clustered around the entrance. It's not Julie's therapy day, so I know she doesn't have a car, but I still feel nervous that I might see her, or she might, at this moment, be seeing me. The parking terrain is vast and includes a 5-level garage that looks empty from here. I park and approach the modern, streamlined steeple and stone facade that has been added to the gargantuan inverted bowl in an unsuccessful attempt to bring it down to human scale. I open one giant glass door and enter a lobby as airy and clean as an airport VIP lounge. Screens hang from the ceiling at regular intervals, their resting faces the church's glowing gate logo. The sea-green carpet is dotted with pristine rugs of white shag across which clean-lined chairs face one another in decorous intimacy. Very soft music is being piped in over invisible speakers, and off in the corner of the vast lobby, a vacuum cleaner drones. Monday must be a slow day. There's a mounted map of the church just to the right of the entrance, and a brief consultation points me in the direction of a corridor with the word Faith hanging over it in brushed steel. The room number I'm looking for is 19F, and I find a moment to wonder whether there's a love wing where all the room numbers have L's in them. The vacuum cleaner shuts off, and looking back, I see my tracks, a line of slightly darker sea-green footprints trailing across the sea-green carpet. That must be where God carried me, I think. I've always had trouble taking religion seriously, but this place seems like a massive joke. The heavy wooden door to 19F is closed and windowless, and after only a moment of hesitation, I push the door open on one end of a room the size of a high school gymnasium. 100 or so people stand hand in hand in a flattened-out oval that runs the length of the room, eyes closed, heads bowed, some rocking back and forth rhythmically, others stock still. I enter and close the door softly behind me, and the low murmuring of the circle enfolds me. I had imagined chairs or somewhere to sit and observe, but there is no room for anything in the windowless hall except the humming, breathing circle. Without opening their eyes or looking at me, the two supplicants nearest the door release each other's hands and take a half step outward, opening the circle and extending their arms. My stomach turns over. This feels much more real than I was expecting, and at the same time, embarrassingly fake. When I step forward and grasp the hands on either side of me, one the dry, rough, thick-jointed hand of an old man, the other the horrifyingly moist and malleable hand of a teenage boy, I am officially an imposter. At first I can't tell where the murmuring is coming from. Amplified around me on all sides and in all keys, it doesn't appear to originate from any one place. I keep my eyes open and run them over as many members of the circle as I can see, but if there's a starting point for the praying, it must be somewhere close to the other end of the oval, the part hidden by its longer side. Looking around, all I see is an endless train of sweatshirted senior citizens, pimpled teenagers, and ponytailed women in yoga pants, all echoing one another's words. I close my eyes, and after a moment, one of the voices seems to separate itself from the muddled sea of noise it's been swimming in and rise a few inches above. It's an ordinary man's voice, the vowels pinched by that indefinable Houston accent. Nevertheless, I can hear the words, crystal clear, as if they were being spoken directly into my ear. Bound. The word drops like a stone into the pool of murmurs. What was lost has been found. Furthermore, it was never lost. Furthermore, it was never lost, echoes the rest of the circle. Do you look to your heavenly Father who offers you armfuls of blessings and ask for a single favor? If you are handed a plate of food at a wedding, do you beg the giver for a bite? You have what you need right in front of you. Do the lilies of the field cast their faces down in supplication? Do the sparrows moan to the heavens in despair? No. The lilies raise their faces to the Lord in awe and delight,
The sparrows lift their voices in songs of praise. They decorate God's creation with their thanks. Does a grateful daughter clothe herself in rags? No. She shows the world her father loves her. She is thankful for his love. What was lost has been found. It was never lost. What was lost has been found. It was never lost. What was lost has been found. It was never lost. What was lost has been found. It was never lost. Some of them continue to chant the phrase while others move on with him, repeating his words just a few seconds after he says them, as clumsily as wet sand on a beach casting itself in the image of the waves that roll over it. What you need is already in your life, the speaker goes on. Christ was wounded forever that we might be whole. Some of the chanters change their mantra at this. One begins weeping loudly. Our Lord has a hole in his side so that we can be whole inside. At this abjectly dumb wordplay, I stifle a snicker, but as the phrase ripples through the circle, taken up by the chorus of voices, the suppressed hiccup undergoes some kind of emotional alchemy in my stomach. Unbelievably, I feel my eyes start to prickle. We are whole in every aspect of our lives. Do you want a new job? You're already doing it. A spouse. You're already married, but neither of you know it yet. Relief from a debt. It has been paid now and forever. A release from pain. There is no pain except in your mind. A second weeper has begun, this one gasping for air in between sobs. Every sob that rings out is immediately encircled and washed away in the mumbling tide, so that the next one feels entirely new, as if it's from a different planet. Rejoice! What was lost has been found. It was never lost. It was you who were lost. The son who was dead is now living again. He who was lost is found. But he was never truly dead. He was never really lost. I can't take much more of this. I snap my eyes open. Nobody notices. Then I spot someone across the circle from me, an elderly woman sitting in a wheelchair wearing a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt. I yank my hands away and grab blindly for the door, my sweaty fingers slipping on the handle as I heave it open and run back across the sea-green carpet where my tracks have already been vacuumed away. Back in my office, I dial the number and the phone rings and rings, but Alex Mercado isn't picking up, so I'll have to find what I'm looking for on my own. I type the damning words into the search engine and wait for the most recent news story to come up. Bomb shelter remains belong to 13-year-old girl, experts say. The lead photo shows a one-story brick bungalow in River Oaks, an old central neighborhood shaded by massive trees and, these days, condos crowded onto two small plots. The house in the photo was being leveled to make way for one more condo, when bulldozers uncovered extra pipelines going to a bomb shelter buried in 10 feet of concrete in the backyard. Another photo shows twisted pipes leading to a broken concrete shell. There are no pictures of what they found inside. I keep digging. The house was seized in 2008 from the owner, nursing home resident Nadine Reynolds, for delinquent property tax payments. Sold at auction to an out-of-town investor who rented it for years without crossing the threshold, it changed hands several times before being picked up in 2015 by the most recent developer, who decided it would make more money as condos. But it's the photo that's important, not the house. I wind up on the Texas DPS website, where there's a statewide database of missing persons, over 300 listings. So many missing. So many unidentified bodies, each one corresponding to a lost daughter or husband or wife or son, like a massive jigsaw puzzle with pieces scattered all over the globe. I click through the most recent Harris County listings and see the thumbnails of male faces with eyes closed, oddly dignified and brutally sad. Then a head-shaped outline with a question mark. The death date is indeterminate. 2008 or 2009, the approximate time all of our lives fell apart. I hold my breath and click, and the photo that has been haunting me pops up.
The horrifying details cropped in order to focus on a single rotted scrap of faded black cloth, shaped like two circles connected by a partially eroded isthmus of faded black. I can see why I didn't recognize it at first. After all, it's been eaten by the air in the bomb shelter for 8 years. No one could have recognized it right away, not even someone who's been carrying around the memory of her daughter's nightshirt for 8 years. A nightshirt now reduced to a pair of Mickey Mouse ears. "I just want the body," I once said in the support group before I left forever. "I just want something to bury." The chorus of police voices and therapist voices and media voices chanting in tandem, "The first 3 hours, the first 3 days," made it hard to conceive of a world in which my daughter was living. Now, I feel a strange numbness settle over me at the thought that she hasn't been, that she isn't. I didn't recognize it right away, because I didn't want to. I didn't want Mercado to be right about Julie being dead. I didn't want him to be right about anything that had to do with my daughter. I wanted to be the one who knew her better than anyone. My cell phone is ringing. It's Alex calling me back. I hit the green icon to pick up, ready to make a full confession, but I never get a chance. "I have some bad news," Alex says. Pete's is what she called them. Even the ones who bought the pills and weed she'd stolen from the shopping cart under the bridge without even asking her to suck their dicks or let them shove them inside her. She'd learned to spit in her hand and wrap it around fast, so there was a chance they'd forget about putting it inside her if she moved quick enough. And if they remembered, it'd go a little easier, be over a little faster. By the time she got to San Francisco, she'd lost track of the men who got her there. But at least she remembered their names. Their names were Pete. Two Petes in the bus station. A Pete in the bathroom of a Diamond Shamrock gas station. One Pete on the bus she'd tried to fight off with the knife, but then she'd let it go and took his wallet instead. He sat next to her the whole way to Sacramento with his dirty fingers interlaced with hers, like they were girlfriend and boyfriend. She turned 14 between Petes, but she wasn't sure when exactly the day passed, and anyway, to Pete's, she was 16. To police, 18. She had the birth year for 18 memorized, and when asked to move along, "How old are you, young lady? Aren't you supposed to be home at this hour?" "Oh, really? What's your birthday?" She gave random dates from that year, once accidentally saying that day's date without realizing it. That policeman said, "Happy birthday," and made a face. The last Pete turned out to be a cop. And when she got into his car and he asked for her date of birth, she'd rattled one off, and he just looked at her and shook his head.
"You're sure you're 18? He said. "You know you could be charged as an adult."
He hit something and a siren went on, and she looked and saw that the doors didn't have locks on the inside and her door didn't even have a handle.
"January 11th, 1989, she said immediately.
It wasn't the right day or the right year, but it put her 2 years closer to her real age.
"That's more like it.
We're going to get you a social worker and get a case opened up on you before you get into a situation you can't get out of."
I've been in one, she thought. I got out.
"I know you think you're tough and all," he said,
giving her a quick sidelong glance.
"But you were about to get picked up by somebody who would have hurt you pretty bad. Juarez owns this block. That was one of his boys in the beater, just before I pulled up."
The rust-blotched Honda had slowed, and the driver had rolled down its window, but then he rolled it up and sped away before she could step off the curb.
"They took off when they saw me. They know I'm a plainclothes cop," he said. "It's a good thing, too, because you were about to get pounded to within an inch of your life. Then you'd get dumped somewhere conveniently near Juarez's place. That's not his real name, by the way. He just wants everyone to think he was a big shot in Mexico. And he'd talk you into a kind of a deal, like you'd crash at his place and work for him. And he'd make sure nobody hassled you out on the street. Make sure nobody ever came after you again. And a week later,
You'd see the one who raped and beat you sitting in your living room, eating a Pop-Tart on your sofa, and you'd figure it out. But it would be too late.
She sat silently during this lecture. Officer Pete, as she had begun to think of him, had a weariness to his voice and a tick of flicking his nose. He did it regularly, a little more toward the end of the speech, so quickly his other hand didn't even whiten on the steering wheel. He cleared his throat.
So, anyway, you're welcome,
he muttered.
Now we're going to meet the nice social worker lady who's going to open a case file on you and get you in a foster home.
She started upright. I don't need to be in a home. I'm 18.
So you said the first time. What's your birthday again?
He laughed.
I bet you can't remember either one of them.
I don't need to be in a home.
I don't want you on the streets getting knifed by some pimp. You haven't been on your own very long, have you?
She considered the question. Was John David on her own? She didn't know, but she shook her head anyway.
I thought so. You've been in town for less than a week?
2 days.
You don't love this work you're doing, do you? It's not your passion.
She shook her head again.
Okay. So you need a place to stay for free. At the very least, you'll go to a group home for a while.
A group home. She'd heard of them. If she didn't know any details, it was only because kids on the street who said, I just ran away from group, weren't saying it to share their life stories. They were saying it to scare the shit out of you. He saw the expression on her face.
Relax. I'm not driving you straight there, he said. You'll talk to Wanda, and Wanda will figure out what to do with you. If you're so scared of group, tell her you want emergency placement. And then you want to be adopted by a nice family that doesn't beat you, or whatever yours did.
He flicked his nose again and stole a glance at her that he probably thought was surreptitious.
I'm sorry about whatever it was. I guess it was pretty bad. Still, this is a hell of a dangerous way to survive. You dead set against going home?
She thought about home for a long moment. It seemed less real than what she had done, not just with the Peets to survive, but the other time. She remembered a wicked little blade and scrambling out of a hole on hands and knees, slippery with blood. She thought of who was waiting for her at the hole's mouth, whose blood was drying on the bunker floor. It wasn't, she said, and tried again. I just needed to get...
To San Francisco, I know.
He sighed deeply, and she hated him with every fiber of her being, the stupid Pete.
You didn't invent it,
he said. She knew she didn't. Pete's did. Janice did. John David did. 12. Tom is finishing off some reheated food at the kitchen table when I get home. There's no sign of Julie.
Where's the money?
I say. The words are thick and wavy as if seen through a streaky window. He puts his fork down.
Anna,
he says, already desperate enough that I know I'm right.
Where is the money in the Julie Fund?
I clarify.
And are you fucking Alma? No.
Liar. I can't believe it even occurs to me to feel anger at this. I have been lying. Julie has been lying. Jane, too, about school, if nothing else. Tom, though. I honestly didn't know there was a part of me left that still needed him to be truthful, to be the good one. But there was. I wanted to have all the bad feelings to myself, cope with Julie's death. Yes, I tell myself, her death, in the worst, most destructive way possible. And he let me think I was doing just that. This is the ultimate betrayal, then. Not that he was the liar, the cheater, this whole time, but that he let me think I was.
Anna, listen, he said. You were drinking so much, and you wouldn't talk to me, you wouldn't listen. I was so alone, you wouldn't even come to the support group with me.
I wanted to yell that I stopped going to the group because it was killing me. The hope, yes, but also the sight of other people's pain, the thought of other people's daughters, only my pain mattered.
Do not put this on me,
I start.
You left, and I needed someone. I didn't love Julie any less than you did. I didn't miss her any less than you did.
You're the one who managed the fund, I say. You're the one who kept up the message board, distributed the flyers. You arranged the damn billboards. You talked to the trustees, and you put Alma in charge of the money.
Yes,
he says. Where's the money, Tom?
I can't talk to you when you're like this.
Like what? You stole Julie's money and gave it to your whore,
Anna.
Deny that you gave it to Alma Ruiz, I say, spitting out the name. He puts his head in his hands.
I gave it to Alma, yes. Some lowlifes working for her ex-husband came forward with a ransom request. Maybe the ex-girlfriend ditched him and he figured out raising a kid alone isn't such a cakewalk, I don't know. I made her the admin so she could sign off on my emptying the account, and I gave it to her for ransom money, and she got her daughter back.
Now deny that you slept with her.
There is a long pause.
Deny it.
Go ahead, I want to hear you. Once, he says, miserable. After that, we went our separate ways.
I guess you'd served your purpose.
He stands up, suddenly angry. You don't get to say that.
I think I get to say whatever I want right now, I say, but he's talking over me.
You think you're telling me something I don't know? Yeah, maybe it was about the money, and maybe I was so damn lonely and messed up. Anyway, we had it, and she didn't. I don't blame her. I would have done the same in a heartbeat to get Julie back. If I thought $50,000 was all it took, I'd have slept with anyone for it. I'd have killed for it.
He's trembling.
You would have, too.
I can't think. I can't let myself think. What if we had needed it for a ransom for Julie?
But we didn't.
He swallows, looks down, then back up at me.
You want me to admit it? I thought she was dead, Anna. It was easier to believe that than to hope.
This breaks him. He bows his head, starts to shudder, dry-eyed, crying, without tears. It is gruesome.
Can you forgive me?
Right here is where I'm supposed to go to him, put my arms around his neck and let him hug my waist, and start crying as I confess that I, too, believed the worst. And follow that with the horrible truth, that I was right, and therefore he was right, too. Right to fuck Alma. Right to save Alma's kid instead of holding out hope for our own, that by the time he was giving the money away, Julie was dead. Dead, dead, dead. But I can't even think about doing any of that because I hate him for not believing in Julie's return. All these years, I doubted it only because I thought he believed. The thought of us, side by side, each locked in our private mausoleums, mourning Julie alone year after year, is depressing and enraging. All these years I've been jealous of his faith. If I'd known he was doubting, I could have been the one to hold out hope. It could have been me going to all those meetings, me keeping the search alive for as long as the money held out. It could have been me.
Anna, please.
He says, looking up. I walk out of the kitchen without saying a word. I've got to get to the meeting I set up with Alex after he told me about the Julie Fund. But first I need to find something in my nightstand. The IHOP on I-10 is too close to the house, but I want this over with fast before I change my mind. The manila envelope has grown fatter, as if it has been eating steadily since the last time I saw it. It no longer closes, but gapes open on the sticky table between us, the contents partially obscured by the dog-eared flap. I wonder what Mercado has collected in that envelope about Tom and me, about Alma Ruiz, about Gretchen Farber. My life, in layer upon layer of sedimentary lies, beneath which, at the very bottom, I can see a glossy corner of the truth. The photograph. I hold the flap to the table with one thumb and pry the picture out. I hold it in my hands and force myself not to look away. The original is so much bigger than the thumbnail and so much more horrible. Bones bleached a dirty yellow by the flash, skull slumped to one side. A crescent of reflected light cradled in each blank eye pit. Scraps of black clinging to the ribcage in that shape I now recognize as an awful parody of a child's cartoon. I just want the body. I try to paint my daughter's face over the skull's awful blankness. I build up the soft cheeks, fill in the eye pits, give her blue eyes and white blonde hair that spills over the ground. But it is too much. And instead I find myself thinking of Julie, of not Julie, of the woman living in my house who says she is my daughter. For money, for kicks, for some other reason too awful to imagine. Her face intrudes even on this moment. The photograph goes blurry, but I keep staring, the tears rolling down my face. I'm so sorry, Anna, Alex says softly, and he puts his hand on my forearm where the muscles that keep my fingers pressed around the photo are jumping. He leaves it there for a long moment, then pulls back. I set her down on the table as gently as I would lay a baby down in a crib. You're sure now, says Alex, voice still low but with the piercing, restless quality already coming back. Why? I reach into my purse, pull out the photograph, put it on the table, and turn both photos toward Alex. He immediately sucks in his breath. The nightshirt, he says. I don't know why I didn't... I had to see them together, to be sure. The photo is from Christmas morning, 9 months before it happened. She's sitting up on her knees in front of the last Christmas tree we ever had, holding her new diary in one hand and the too large box we'd purposely wrapped it in to throw her off the trail in the other, smiling with the goofy, groggy happiness of a child still young enough to care about Christmas. Why don't the police have this? Alex mutters, still staring. They asked for recent pictures, I explain. I just didn't think to. I mean, look at her. She's still a little girl. But it was only 9 months between when the picture was taken and when Julie disappeared. How could she have changed so much in 9 months? It's the smile, of course. This is the last picture of Julie smiling the way kids do, with her mouth all the way open, showing her teeth. Shortly after that, she became a closed-lipped teenager, and then she was gone. No, no, he says. I mean, there's not even one photo of her in that nightshirt anywhere in the case files, just a description. I assumed you just didn't have any. That's exactly the kind of carelessness that would never have happened if this had been treated... He breaks off, shakes his head, looks at the two photos again, and sighs. Well... This puts that theory to bed anyway. What theory? That Julie ran away. I stare at him. Oh, come on, Anna. You had to know that was a possibility. It just didn't look like a kidnapping. He shakes his head. Why do you think they investigated you and Tom so closely?
But Jane saw...
Eyewitness testimony from a 10-year-old. At that angle, from a dark closet in a dark house. Not particularly reliable, he says. Honestly, Anna, there was always more than a little reason to believe she'd made it all up or was convinced to lie. Or if she did see something, didn't understand what she was seeing.
But...
They gave her a lollipop for sitting so long with a police sketch artist, I want to say. But the words sound stupid even in my head.
The investigation...
Sure, big, high-profile case, leave no stone unturned. With no other leads, they were ready to take her story seriously. In public, at least. Behind closed doors, though. Believe me, I was there. I know where it was headed. I saw all the signs.
No,
I say. It seems important to keep saying this because what he is implying is actually worse than my worst nightmare. It's something I have never even repressed. I never had to, because I simply never thought of it. Although now, with the word runaway instead of abduction ringing in my ears, I suddenly wonder why not. As if reading my mind, he pries back the index finger of his left hand with the index finger of his right and starts on his list of evidence.
Minimal signs of forced entry. Almost staged, like someone just jiggled a lockpick around for a while, then opened the door with a key. The alarm wasn't even on.
We sometimes...
I know you didn't set it every night, okay, he says. Could be. Or could be she disarmed it herself.
He moves on to the middle finger.
No weapon.
The knife.
Your knife, which he takes from the kitchen after he breaks in. He comes to this house in the middle of the night completely unarmed, and he walks straight up the stairs. He knows exactly which room.
We went over all this with the police. They said he must have staked out the house.
I'm not saying he didn't, Alex reminds me. I'm saying what the police were saying. I was there, remember? I've seen the file.
I sink, deflated, back into my booth.
They didn't believe there was any man. And even if there was, she almost had to have known him, Anna.
I struggle to keep from raising my voice, and it comes out strangled.
Look, I don't care if she knew him beforehand or not. She was 13. That's child abduction. Absolutely, still a crime. But a very different kind of investigation. Runaways are a lot harder to find because they don't want to be found.
He waits for a second as if weighing whether to speak, then goes ahead.
I don't know how to put this. If she'd been in my neighborhood, there would have been no question that she was a runaway.
But Julie was only 13.
So was Stephanie Vargas. She climbed into a car with a friend of the family in 2005. My little sister went to high school with her brother. We didn't lift a damn finger for the Vargas family. She and her brother were staying with an uncle while Mom visited relatives in Mexico.
He sighs.
Stephanie was a straight-A student. She played the clarinet. She practiced every day.
He looks straight into my eyes.
Her body was found less than a mile from her house, dumped in a drainage ditch.
I shut my mouth. His face looks older, years older, and I can see the shadow of punches thrown. It fills me with rage.
So you knew, I say. You knew about this. You knew they weren't really looking for Julie, because they didn't really look for this other girl. And instead of coming forward, instead of fighting for all those girls, for Julie, 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 you just fucking quit.
I didn't quit. I was kicked off.
That's not what you told me before.
I lied.
You and everybody else, I think.
So why didn't you come to us back then? I ask, relentless. If you're such a white knight, where were you 8 years ago when it mattered?
I can't say for sure, but if I had to guess, I'd say blackout drunk in a public restroom somewhere, he says. Or in a parking lot, or behind a dumpster. It takes effort and determination to get kicked off the force just for being a drunk. Really fills up your social calendar.
He sighs.
Look, to be honest, even after I sobered up, I wasn't too sure of myself.
He leans forward.
But I've tried to find her. Please believe me, Anna, I've tried.
Why do you even care?
He shrugs uncomfortably. Some cases you never forget. They just nag at you. You're sure you screwed the pooch, but there's no proof.
We both stare at the photos on the table.
Until now. We don't need a DNA sample, not with this. I can take it to the police. You lay low. You don't even need to be involved. They'll compare the forensic report on the remains with Julie's records, and we'll find out what we already know.
He looks me in the eye.
Just say the word.
But I can't say anything.
Do I have your permission?
I look away. I nod.
I know it's too late, Anna. I know I can never undo what I did or didn't do while I was drinking, but this is all I've got.
He pauses.
It's all I can do to make amends.
I don't want your amends. I want my baby.
Baby woke up without opening her eyes. Her insides hurt, like her stomach was a fist squeezing itself as hard as it could. Or like falling asleep with a rubber band and wet hair and trying to pull it out in the morning. Like something that wouldn't let go, grabbing at something that wasn't there anymore. She doubled up to push the walls of her insides tighter together to fill the hole, but her body moved sluggishly, and when she tried to wrap her arms around her knees, her wrists felt pinned to the ground by powerful magnets. She stayed like that, curled on her side, knees to chin, arms dead. Her body was slow, but her mind was waking up fast. The absence that hurt her stomach sang in her ears like an alarm bell, ringing louder and louder, shivering up and down her spine. She had won. Esther was bleeding out of her onto a fat strip of towel wedged thick between her legs. Esther was gone at last, and, with her, the last of John David. She tried to conjure up his image, the way she had seen him once, wearing a wobbling halo of light. But when she saw a halo of light now, it was the glowing globe in the kitchen where she lay hard-backed on the table with her legs spread wide, and the darkness at the center of the light wasn't John David, but a man in scrubs with a surgical mask and gloves, who gave her a sweet pill to melt her to the table until she sank right through it. Then her spirit went up. Up toward the light fixture, where the outlines of winged insects with burned-out guts lay in a dusty pile. With her last bit of will, she flew up into that globe light and let her tissue get burned right out of her. And now she was an outline only she could fill in. When she woke up again, she was in so much more pain that she could hardly stand it. The bed hurt her bones. Where was she? Because it was dark outside, it took a moment to realize she wasn't on a bed at all. She lay on a slanted, corrugated slab of concrete under a bridge, the smell of gasoline and something sour filling her nostrils. Janice sat a few feet away, her head and shoulders emerging from a mass of blankets. She stirred, and Janice turned toward her.
"Hey, baby, you feeling better?"
Janice asked. She leaned forward and adjusted some of the blankets without leaving her own nest.
"You've been making some noise there."
She opened her mouth to say, "It hurts," but there was only a gasp of air where her voice should be, just as if the fist in her belly were squeezing her lungs, too. Janice nodded.
"Yeah, you got the cramps," she said. "They're nasty. I had the cramps real bad after mine."
At the thought of Janice with a baby in her belly, she blinked.
"I got nothing to give you for it, baby,"
Janice continued.
"Oh, don't look at me like that. They don't send you home with nothing over at Smith's place. They give you one big double dose to knock you on your ass, but after that it's, nah, you gonna sell it, or you gonna snort it. Baby, they don't give you nothing at Doc Smith's. They don't trust you for shit."
She was talking more to herself now, but loud, as if she had an audience under the bridge, where the pigeons were wedged up under the shit-streaked concrete like a row of stuffed animals on a shelf. She opened her mouth to speak again, but her breath kept snagging.
"What is it, baby?" "Stop calling me baby."
Janice just looked at her, unimpressed.
"Well, you ain't wig girl anymore. What's your name?"
She thought for a minute. She stayed silent.
"That's right, baby," Janice said. "You can be baby for a little while. It won't kill you."
She leaned over again, put out her hand. The fingers touched baby's hair, and baby couldn't help it. She relaxed. The fingers were warm and heavy against her scalp, and the rough, dry skin caught her hair and gave it little pulls, and her own skin tingled around the pulled hairs. Baby lay on her side all night, but she couldn't sleep. Her stomach ached so much she couldn't imagine feeling anything else.
"You just need something to eat," Janice said. "Hang on, we'll get something when Pete comes by."
Baby didn't ask who Pete was. She just nodded. They waited and waited for Pete. Cars swooshed by at random intervals, sometimes several at a time, sometimes 30 seconds with none, and then only one every 10 seconds for a while. Baby counted them, but she couldn't see what color they were or what kind. Janice stared carward, immobile as the pigeons. When Pete finally came, though, Baby knew she, too, had been sitting like a pigeon all this time, because Pete brought so much motion to the concrete ramp that Baby felt self-conscious, even while fresh rounds of cramps made her insides rattle like the wheels of the shopping cart that Pete pushed in front of him. When he got close, he pulled some scraps of blanket from around his wrist and tied them around the shopping cart's wheels so it wouldn't roll down the concrete slope.
"Took you long enough," said Janice. "I thought we were going to rot over here." Look, Pete, I gotta get her taken care of so I can go get something to eat. I'm starving. I've been taking care of this baby all day and all night.
What do you need, Jay?
Pete asked without looking at baby even for a second.
What do you have to take the edge off? She said. Oops.
You wish,
Pete said.
I can get you some later, but you have to hook me up, understand?
Tylenol.
No way, sorry.
What the hell are you good for, Pete? Why have we been sitting here all night waiting for your sorry ass?
Go down to camp if you want Tylenol.
Not with this one, she said, looking at baby again. She can't fend yet.
Or the clinic.
We're not going to any more clinics for a while, Janice said in a low, gravelly tone.
Fine,
he said.
What I've got's a little weed. That's all I've got for now.
I knew you weren't useless, she smiled. Come on, baby, I got something for you. It's gonna help, trust me.
Baby willed her limbs to move, but the bumpy concrete was harder to navigate than she thought.
Come on, do you want it or don't you? It's gonna fix those cramps up for you, and then I can go get us something to eat.
Baby pushed herself halfway upright and saw Pete looking at her for the first time. A warm, rank scent filled the air, something like the insides of shoes, but also like the steam off a cup of tea, not entirely unpleasant.
Here, honey, Janice said, pushing the joint in her face.
Baby had seen a joint before when a boy brought one to school, though some other boys said it was oregano. It was certainly not something she ever would have associated with the smell that hit her in the face when Janice handed her the twist of brittle paper, warm from the burning breath that had already passed through it.
You gotta be kidding me, Janice said,
seeing her confusion.
Like this, baby, see?
She kissed the wrinkled tip of the joint with her cracked and puckered lips, sucked, held the lungful of smoke, and exploded it out with a cough.
You really are a baby.
She passed the joint, and baby took it. Tentatively kissed the moist tip and sucked in. The smoke surprised her. A square feeling in her chest, something with corners and hard edges. She tried to hold it, but her lungs convulsed, punching the smoke back out into the air. She started coughing uncontrollably.
That's fine, Janice said. Take another. Don't worry about me, baby. You finish that yourself. It's all for you. I was just showing you.
Sure,
said Pete.
I don't want any. Never saw you turn down a joint, though, Jay.
I was just showing baby how, she said.
Meanwhile, baby was coughing again, but a thick syrup had dripped down over her so she hardly even felt like she was coughing. Then came a deliciousness in her stomach that was like the easing of the fist. Or maybe, when she noticed it, the fist was still there, clenched as tight as ever, but she didn't care anymore because all the muscles had started turning into elastic one by one, or something gummier that could stretch forever like silly putty. Her skin shivered under scores of hair follicles that seemed to have turned into little antennae, and her whole body dissolved into points of light. Or bubbles, like the ones in a soft drink. She felt so happy, so safe. Even the under freeway had turned into a vault, and she was something precious tucked away inside, hidden where no one could find her.
You feeling a little better, baby?
Said Janice, and now she could nod. Her mouth opened up as if on its own, and,
yes, thank you,
came out as if from a pull-string dolly.
So polite. That's good. That's real good. You keep puffing on that. But you're gonna get hungry next. I gotta go get some food from the camp. Here's Pete. He's gonna look after you while I'm gone.
Baby shook her head from side to side at the sight of Janice rising to her feet. Suddenly, Janice looked very skillful standing on her two feet, since the whole world was tilted and she was balancing perfectly on the side of it. Baby twisted her neck to make the world go straight again, but it settled back into a slant, and she remembered that it really was slanted, and that struck her as funny. So funny that she started laughing and laughing. Her stomach hurt from laughter, not from cramps, unless they were the same thing. She had forgotten what the cramped feeling was about. There was nothing inside her. She was nothing. By now, Janice was gone. And suddenly, baby understood what was happening with crystal clarity. It was too late for her to move, of course. She was pigeoned against the concrete like a doll on a shelf with huge, glassy eyes that wouldn't stay closed, Even when Pete began fumbling at her clothes under her sleeping bag, and the smells of him became overwhelming.
Okay, she told herself, because the panic was starting to rise in her, thick and warm, and she knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that screaming